Hey, this is Cedric. Today's episode with Matt Hill is brought to you by Ledin.io, a better home for your Bitcoin. Ledin is a secure, simple, and easy-to-use platform for managing and growing your digital wealth. With industry-best interest rates on savings, use your Bitcoin as collateral for loans or double your Bitcoin stack with their Buy 2X program. As of November 1st, you can now start earning 9.5% APY on your USDC and 6.25% on your first two Bitcoin. Already a Ledin client? From now on, when a new Ledin client signs up using your referral link and funds their Bitcoin or USDC savings account, they can receive 10 USDC as a reward deposited straight into their account. Listeners of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast still can get an exclusive offer of 50 free USDC when you become a Ledin user and take out a Ledin loan using our link. Learn more, sign up, and get earning at start.ledin.io/Bitcoin Matrix. And now, let's turn our attention to this fantastic conversation with Matt Hill, where we discuss sovereign computing, the private web, and whether machines will be the ones serving us in the future.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Matt Hill is a passionate leader by example with 12 years experience building products, teams, and companies. Matt is the CEO co-founder of Start9 Labs, founder and developer of WorkBlast, the co-creator of Borker, and the co-architect and former CTO of Salt Lending. Matt also won a silver in the National Olympics for Taekwondo at age 9. Just like self-defense, privacy is a natural human right and must be enforced by technology. Start9 designs simple personal servers that run self-hosted open source applications. The era of sovereign computing starts here. Matt Hill, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
I would like to correct one small point about the introduction, which is that I was not a co-architect of Salt Lending, the company. I was a co-architect of Salt Lending's technology stack. And I want to make that differentiation because Salt Lending, the company, is not something I necessarily agree with, but we did build some very nice technology over there.
Yeah, fair enough. I figured you might comment on something in the intro, but I really kind of wanted to just note those just because I see it as demonstrating that you're a builder and yes. And a developer and that you ship things and are making things happen in the real world or the non-digital world. As well as interface with the digital world, obviously, but you're leading companies and you've developed things, which is awesome. And I also noted the, you know, winning the silver in the National Olympics at age 9, just because of, you said something interesting on podcast, The Boy Named Sue, where young kids are not, built with defenses. And what that demonstrated to me is that you learned how to defend yourself. But the reason I bring that up is I don't think adults right now have all the defenses we need or aware of where we're sort of defenseless. And so, yeah, I just thought it was an interesting parallel in sort of your defiance or sort of work ethic. And I just noted that.
Yeah. Would you like me to comment on, some of my Taekwondo experiences or?
Sure. I was just the other day I was around a family barbecue and it's interesting how some of the kids will just kind of rough and tumble and go at it. Yeah. And some of the kids don't really gravitate towards that. So yeah, if you could just.
Sure. It's a nice correlation drawing, defense, martial arts and defense, physical defense of the body with, the broader topic of defense over one's life in all areas. But for me that, Taekwondo was not me thinking I need to defend myself. I'm afraid of somebody at school or, Taekwondo for me, for anyone who knows Taekwondo, it is less of a combat and defensive art and more of a mental art. Taekwondo is mental discipline and perfection expressed through the body. You know, one could use that same description with dance or something, right? And in that sense, it would be an apt comparison. Taekwondo can be used as a martial art. It can be used as both offensive and defensive purposes. But I personally, I did some sparring, I did some board breaking, and I was good at those and I won some medals. But my expertise where I excelled was in forms, you know, where you are actually sort of shadow performing a dance of martial arts, where you're on the stage alone and you are sort of doing a performance. And, you know, there are strict forms that everyone performs. Everyone performs the same form. It's not like gymnastics floor routines where everyone does their own routine. Everyone is doing the same exact routine and you are being judged on how perfectly you execute that routine. And so it came down to the positioning of your pinky, right? The angle of your kicks. Everything was about perfection. And for me, that is what did it. It was the constant refinement of the movement towards perfection. And I had a wonderful, wonderful master in Master Cho, who really saw something in me and gave me a chance and encouraged me, and was an incredible human being. He was very well respected. He was the president of the United States Taekwondo Federation. He was a 9th degree black belt. When he died, he was awarded his 10th honorary 10th, which is very rare. And he loved me and I loved him back. And that relationship was, you know, amongst the rest of my family members, the most meaningful relationship of my childhood. And so Taekwondo lives with me to this day. The lessons I learned from it, courtesy, integrity, self-control, perseverance, and an indomitable spirit are quite literally how I live. Those are the tenets of Taekwondo and they are the principles of my life.
Yeah. Do you find that you, your coworkers now, or the, you know, sort of the vocation that you've endeavored on, you find a lot of those similar traits in the people you gravitate towards now in work aspects?
I seek them actively in everyone in my life. Yes. Not to the same degree as me, maybe. I'm intense. I also have a sense of humor. If you ask the guys at the office, I tend to be cracking jokes, but I'm an intense person. I take myself and the world seriously. And I tend to gravitate towards people who exemplify the same principles, that I do and, who mean it, you know, most importantly, integrity.
Yeah. So when did you find yourself pivoting towards building Start 9 and the Embassy product service?
Start 9 and the Embassy, it was not then known as Start 9 or the Embassy, came about after my and my co-founder's departure from Salt Lending. We don't need to get into the details of that departure. We were dissatisfied. We left and we didn't know what we were going to do. But I knew that these were the best people I had ever worked with, both from a talent and principled perspective. And I very much intended to pursue something with them. And I was no, you know, beginner in the startup world. I had done other startups, and had succeeded and failed to varying degrees. But had come up with some ideas on what works and what doesn't work. And I felt very strongly that if I took me and the three of them and shoved us in a room together and closed the door and didn't let anybody out until we had a company, that something pretty special would come out of that room. And we went through a couple different ideas. And ultimately, Start 9 came about almost serendipitously, just because I wanted to set up a Lightning node in order to play on Lightning with Keegan, who had just set his up. And, you know, I'm a pretty technical guy. I can code, I can dev, I can set up a Lightning node, but within even a few minutes of getting into the documentation for LND, I was just like, this is going to take me all weekend, maybe longer. I'm going to be fighting with configurations and build scripts. And I was like, isn't there just a, you know, why can't I just well, can I just click a button? Where's that convenience? And even then we knew that lightning was going to be an important thing in this world. And so, you know, I figured the conveniently being able to set up a lightning node might be a valuable thing in this world. And at the time, Casa was the closest, I believe, to having anything like that. And so our first step was to investigate Casa. It was, okay, well, what have they done? How does it work? Where are they going? And so Keegan and I actually went and met with Jameson and Nick and talked to them about that. We asked them some pretty, you know, probing questions about where they intended to take Casa as a business. And by the end of that meeting, you know, we weren't talking with them to try to see how we could compete. We were talking with them to see how we might be able to cooperate. We were actually interested in potentially joining Casa if they were going in a direction that we, you know, liked. And we do like the direction that they went in, but it wasn't the direction that we wanted to go in. And by the end of the dinner, it was very clear that they were not going to pursue what we thought was a huge opportunity. And so we left and we were like, well, do we do it? Do we take this on? Do we fire up Boss? You know, we were originally, it was called Bitcoin OS. We were going to write the Bitcoin operating system, an operating system that would run Bitcoin and Bitcoin related services in a GUI, user-friendly, non-technical way. And, you know, we got with Aiden and Aaron, the other two who were around at the time, and we decided that we would pursue it. So that's it. We decided to build an operating system for Bitcoin. And then it just kind of went crazy from there. We realized that if we were building an operating system that could accommodate Bitcoin, inherently, it would be able to accommodate other things. And then we took that, you know, sort of extrapolation and ran with it and realized that what we were really building, what we were really setting out to build, was an operating system for a personal server. And there really wasn't one. The world does not have a user-friendly graphical operating personal server operating system.
Sure. Or in that, is it redundant? Are all personal servers self-sovereign?
Sure. If you have the word personal on there and you mean it. Yeah. Sure. If it's a personal server. Now, doesn't necessarily mean that everything you're running on that server is self-sovereign. Like you can have a personal server in your house and, you know, hook up to the Google API with it. So,
yeah. Right. So not everybody who's, yeah. So everyone who's buying a personal server in the sort of the legacy IT world might not be using it for self-sovereignty.
Sure.
So it's really interesting to me that this is born out of Bitcoin, or, you know, the love or the wanting to take Bitcoin further or access Bitcoin. But I see this as so beyond Bitcoin, or in just so many different sectors and silos, and, you know, the way it just enables you to be sovereign with your data. And I just don't think, you know, people really think about this enough in terms of, you know, you're exposing your personal and private information to companies like Google and Facebook and Coinbase and Amazon. And can you describe how, you know, this is sovereign computing is different than just sort of hooking up to a Google GUI, how what we're with like Tor and sort of the stack of the Embassy product and Embassy OS, what you're achieving here?
It's a hard problem in like the traditional sense of that word, what we are trying to solve here, right? This is a hard problem to do sovereign computing for a non-technical person, right? Highly technical people have a difficult time engaging in truly sovereign, trust minimized, independent computing. It requires you to really watch your tracks to not slip up. It requires you to circumvent many centralized, highly convenient services without which it's hard to do simple things. You know, even the architecture of the internet itself poses a potential threat in that you are utilizing, you know, DNS, the DNS system, your ISP can see things. You have to take measures to really be private. It's not private by default. The world is not private by default. You have to really go out of your way. And so taking something that is inherently difficult, even for highly technical people to do, and making it available to non-technical people, is a very hard problem. It's a UX challenge. You know, it is a technical challenge. We're breaking ground here on the operating system side. And I don't just mean in the UX, which is also very tough to get right. But what we are able to do under the hood, I mean, we haven't put it outside the consideration that what we're building could end up being very useful to businesses, companies, because right now, if you're a company, and even if you're using AWS, right, and not self-hosting on your own metal, right? So very few companies actually have physical servers in their offices these days. Most are using things like AWS or Azure, and they're, to do that, paying DevOps engineers, right? Often more than one, to maintain these systems. And those are highly specialized, highly technical, highly paid individuals. And part of the reason that they're highly paid is because it's really hard to do. It requires an intelligent person with lots of training and specialized education. And what we are doing is simplifying the DevOps engineer role, right? We are adding automation and insight and tooling to running server-side software, which is very hard to do, especially when it comes to maintaining uptime, maintaining health, reacting to issues. And that's what Embassy OS is designed to do, right? We did not take an operating system like Linux and just put a bunch of software on it and call it an operating system, right? We know people who do that. That's not what we did. We wrote a new operating system. It's a fork of Linux that does a whole lot more, right, than just having services running on an OS. Our GUI, especially the one that's upcoming here very soon now, really takes this experience to a whole other level, not just in its ease of use, but in its reliability and performance. Embassy will be unmatched in reliability and performance, which is really where the problem lies, right? It's not hard to put a bunch of software on Linux and then walk away. That's not very hard to do. What's hard to do is to keep it running, right?
Yeah. It's, it, you know, I got one. And it's one of those things where I was intimidated at first. And I sat on it for a bit, as I do most, sometimes new tech. And when I got to open it up and get it going, it was so easy to start and use. And I was up so much faster than I could have ever imagined. I mean, it was super simple. And I do kind of want to touch on some of the things that are available on the device. So like probably others, I thought of it like yourself. I wanted to get my Lightning node up and running and my Bitcoin node up and running. And I thought about these other things, and it was the reason I went for the Embassy, but like it wasn't my primary reason. And now I see it as my primary, you know, personal server. And that is almost more important to me than just the Bitcoin functionality. So it has, you know, Bitcoin and LND, but it has Matrix for messaging, BTC pay server, Bitwarden, the password manager, which I think is awesome, a file browser, Mastodon, Sphinx chat, other messengers, bar, burn after reading. It's really sort of just an entree. I think it was a physical citadel for my data.
Digital, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. How do you see this as a gateway to the internet?
That's interesting. That's an interesting phrasing of it. So we actively try to guide the language around Embassy, right? It is mostly me, where I am constantly kind of harping on the team to use the word services as opposed to the word apps, for instance, right? This is an intentional thing because we're creating new brain space, right? What we are doing here is not an iteration of an existing product. Right. We are inventing something new that most people are unfamiliar with. It is a new kind of product. Some people are familiar with it, right? engineers who run their own servers, DevOps engineers at companies, companies that run their own servers, maybe wealthy individuals who pay people to run servers for them. They might be roughly familiar with the concept of a server and its purpose, but the vast majority of people are not. And so we are trying to create this new brain space and like to use language very efficiently to do that. And so what you said as a gateway to the internet is something we do not say, because it's not quite what the embassy is, right? It is, a lot of people come in and they think the embassy is some sort of a cloaking device for the internet. Like it's a way for them to go about their business on the internet, but privately. And we go, oh no, no. A VPN might be something like that, right? Or a privacy browser might be something like that. But the embassy doesn't do that at all. It doesn't do anything to increase your privacy on the internet.
Yep.
Thinking of it as a gateway to the internet is almost like, okay, so I can enter the internet through a like secret gateway, and therefore I'm anonymous on the internet or something like that. And again, not the case. The embassy is private territory on the internet, which is why we called it the embassy. Right? That was very intentional. It's not just because it sounded cool. It's because the concept, the analogy holds. This is your territory in somebody else's land, right? In public land. So you have the internet, which is, we'll call it public land, even though it's largely conquered at this point. But the embassy is your citadel, your private section of that land, where you're not, the embassy is not moving around that land. It's a destination unto itself. Mm. You actually go to your embassy. So no matter where you are in the world, you want to do your computing, right? You want to go fetch some data or save some new data or talk to your friends, or you want to, you know, do password management or run a Bitcoin node or transact using Lightning. You go to your embassy to do those things. Your embassy then has, we'll call them emissaries, that can sort of run out into the internet and do your bidding, but they are cloaked. Okay. These are the messages that are relayed over Tor. So for instance, your LND node that's running in your embassy is, of course, as with your Bitcoin node, connected to other Bitcoin and LND nodes running all over the internet. So you go to your embassy to use Bitcoin, but your embassy's Bitcoin node is secretly, privately connected to other people's Bitcoin nodes. You can almost think of them as like underground pipes, right? Flowing out from your embassy to the greater internet. So we actually are hijacking the internet for private use case. We're not using the public internet. We're sort of building a tunnel system underneath it, which is most commonly referred to as the dark net.
Right.
We didn't invent the dark net. We are leveraging the dark net for private use.
Yeah, it makes it easy for someone like me to interact with the private web or the dark net.
Which has always been difficult, right? Like if in the past, if you wanted to, and not only has it always been difficult, but it's always not been super attractive. Like what were you going to do on the dark net, right? Like most things that are underground, it was largely used for, we'll call it nefarious or at least illegal purposes, even if not nefarious. But people do want privacy, and this realm,
that's what I like about,
affords that, right? So we don't even like calling it the dark net. We like just calling it the private net, the private internet. Mm-hmm. And the fact that some people will use the private internet for illegal or bad things has nothing to do with us. We're using the same thing for a very positive purpose, which is so that average, normal individuals who do not trust big corporations or big government with their data and lines of communication. It's a very normal thing. Until very recently, this would have been a very normal thing throughout human history. Somebody being like, I'd like to talk to my family in private without somebody listening in on it. Not because I have something horrible to say, but because it's just weird that Apple is sitting in my living room, that there's some employee from six different companies listening to every conversation that I have. It's just not natural. And I think it's causing a lot of very, sort of subliminal psychological damage. I think that the idea that everything is being monitored and watched, and even if you have nothing to say, it's just, you know, you're being watched, and it has this really kind of wearing, dulling effect on your psyche. I think it breaks people down.
Yeah. I think it's so insidious and even hard to, really hard to detect. And I think we've just unfortunately grown accustomed to this. And that's why I see this as such, you know, the bright embassy future. I think of this as how the embassy changes you or me, the way I think about how Bitcoin changes you or me. I think this is a very sort of dynamic service, and it's sort of been an inflection point in my own ability to defend myself. You know, I think of myself as someone who is comfortable with technology, where I like discussing it, I like utilizing it, but I don't want to run my own personal server, you know, with a command line prompt and things of that nature. And this made it super easy for me to get up and running. And do you think it lets people operate with impunity on the web?
Not on the web, but you can operate with impunity on your embassy, right? Again, the web is the communication system. It's the nervous system. But when you use your embassy properly, you're actually not on the internet. You're hijacking the internet's infrastructure to be on your embassy.
Right.
So the question, right? I don't want to nitpick the semantics here.
Yeah.
I understand the point of your question. So what you're asking is can somebody stop you? Right? Can somebody, like, is there a vulnerability? Is there a way around what we have built, right? Can it be hijacked? And the answer to that is that it can, that there's no such thing as perfect privacy. There never will be. It's always going to be a cat and mouse game between defensive and offensive technology in this world, right? It just so happens that offensive technology has significantly outrun defensive technology in the last few decades, which has put the individual at risk. And so we are a natural, almost cosmic reaction, Bitcoin, things like Bitcoin, start and I, we are a natural cosmic reaction to an imbalance in nature, right? Defensive technology is on the rise again, and it's called decentralization, right? A decentralized technologies utilizing cryptography are digital defense systems for the individual. All we're trying to do is make them easier to use so that everyone can have access to these defensive technologies. So can they be had? Well, not easily. We believe that what we are working on, what we've already built and what we are improving every day, would require you to be a very high profile individual for you to be compromised. Somebody highly technical and highly resourced would have to really want to get at you in order for them to have you. The vast majority of people that use an embassy today have an almost zero threat model against their communications and data if they use it properly, because they're not on the FBI's 10 most wanted list.
Sure.
And that's the kind of resources that it would take to break somebody's embassy. Now, it's a physical device sitting in your home. Okay. So there's the physical aspect of it that needs to be protected, right? If somebody breaks into your home and says, "Give me the password," well, cryptography can't help you there. So it's only as secure as the physical premise is secure. But with that in mind, it's secure. If the device and you are safe, your data and your lines of communication are also safe for almost all cases.
Yeah. Can you elaborate on how one interacts with the device using either your phone or your own computer, and then sort of like maybe the software stack and how it utilizes Tor and what that technology does or enables the software to achieve?
Yeah, absolutely. So when you set up your embassy, there is a key exchange process that takes place between whatever device you're using to set it up, so your computer or your phone, and the embassy itself, where your phone will generate a random ED25519 private key. And along with that, you will choose a password, right? So you generate a random key. and you choose a password for yourself. And then your phone or computer takes that information. So by the way, you are connected to your embassy on the local area network of your home, right? So you have to plug, I should go back a step. You have to plug the embassy into power and router, okay? Now you can find that device on the local area network in O3O simply by visiting embassy.local. You'll just open up a browser and go to embassy.local. This is different than how you set it up. You had to download an app called the setup app and set it up. We're making it even easier. So you'll go to your browser, you open embassy.local, and that connection between your phone or laptop and your embassy is unencrypted. It is over HTTP, not HTTPS. It can't be over HTTPS because there's no certificate. Your phone and computer don't have access to the embassy's root certificate authority. So your browser won't trust it. So inherently, the initial communication between whatever device you're using and your embassy is, quote, insecure, which means anyone on your local area network of your home who is sufficiently technical to sniff that traffic can do so. So what we did to circumvent this obscure vulnerability, because who's on the local area network of your home sniffing traffic? Probably nobody. So this isn't a big deal for most people, but we went the extra mile and wanted to make sure that if even if somebody was, that you would still be secure. For example, if you were doing this on like a public network where you lived with lots of roommates and you don't know, you don't trust them, right? Because if they sniff this, it's over, right? They have you forever. They have everything forever. So what we did was we came up with a product, what we call a product key scheme. So what we do is we randomly generate product keys and we put them on the bottom of the device. Right. We engrave them onto the bottom. And these product keys act as encryption keys and one-time passwords for the initial setup. So now, in addition to sniffing your home network, whoever is doing so would have to know this key because the operating system image itself has this key, it knows it, and it's printed on the bottom of the device, so you, the human, know it. And because both entities are aware of this secret, we use that secret to encrypt communications back and forth. So even though the communication is taking place over HTTP, it's fully encrypted using a product key that's printed on the bottom of the device. Mm. So for somebody to have you, not only would they have to be on your local area network sniffing traffic, but they would also have to see underneath your device. So if you take it out of the box and you flip it over and you type it in and nobody can see you, you're safe. 100%. Nobody can see that traffic. Nobody can sniff it. So the setup process is very secure. The result of that setup process, because now that your phone or computer has handed the embassy this two secrets, right? An 825519 private key and your chosen password, the embassy now uses those two secrets to do two things. One is it uses the private key to spin up a Tor V3 hidden service URL. This is a blah, 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 blah dot onion URL. And it spits that out at you. And now that from here forward is where your embassy lives. That is where it has planted its flag and built itself in the land of the internet. Your embassy is now a place. It's a destination. A secret destination, mind you, because Tor V3 URLs are actually just public keys that correspond to the private key that was generated randomly on your phone at the time of setup. So not only is your embassy, your private territory in the land of the internet, secure, but it is invisible. Nobody even knows it exists, let alone has access to it. Then the password you gave to your embassy is a second layer of defense, because even if somebody gets a hold of your address, like if you accidentally leak it or something like that, no big deal. They would go to that web page and the first thing they would see is a login page and they don't know your password, so they can't get in. So there's two lines of defense. One is that the location of your embassy is super secret and nobody knows it's there. And then secondly, if somebody does find that it's there, they would also need your password to get in. And then that's it. So you log in. You log in from any Tor-enabled browser, phone or computer, or desktop, whatever, laptop, desktop, and you are now presented with a what looks like a normal kind of website, right? It's just a dashboard. It's our operating system. It's our GUI, graphical user interface of our operating system, served through the browser over Tor. And you install stuff, do whatever you want now, you know?
Yeah, it's awesome. How is the Embassy combined with the Embassy OS different from, say, like the MyNote or something like that?
Sure. There are some pretty fundamental differences. I will preface anything I say about some of our, I don't want to call them competitors, because there's actually a fundamental sort of difference in product offering, right? We are a sort of a broader topic, is that we like them. We like MyNote. I think that what they have built is very solid. We like what they've brought to the world. It's a lot of hard work. And so I don't want anything that I'm going to say to diminish what they have brought to the world. But there are some important differences that I think people would be interested in. First and foremost, and I mentioned this kind of earlier in the talk, is that MyNote and others like it are essentially a bunch of open source services that are sort of bundled together and installed onto a operating system, right, a Linux-based operating system. It's like if you had a friend who was technical come over to your house and open up your terminal and just start typing a bunch of stuff. Like, all right, I'm going to install Bitcoin. Okay, now I'm going to install Lightning. Okay, I'm going to do this. And here, write this password down. And they just sort of like install all the things onto your computer and then give you, you know, a couple lines of instructions on like, okay, like here's how you use it, you know, and I'll see you later. And then from then on, you know, things are there and they work, and you can, you know, go to these websites and you can plug into them from third-party apps. And there's not a lot of insight into kind of what's happening under the hood, right? Again, as a non-technical person, it's almost like magic. You're just like, oh, these things are like running. But server-side software, I should say all software, but more pronounced in sort of server-side software that's highly network integrated, never just works. It always goes wrong. There's always some power outage or, you know, internet downtime, or maybe Tor's misbehaving. And that's just the beginning. Then you get into configurations. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, well, Bitcoin has what, 1,000 options in the bitcoin.com file that you can tweak to govern your node. Well, what if you want to change one of those? How do you do that? Mm-hmm. Right? With MyNode and others, you are getting on your terminal window, you are SSHing into the box, you are, you know, CDing into different directories and opening up nano or vim and then editing a .conf file. And if you, God forbid, you enter one wrong key and hit save, your Bitcoin node will just start crashing and you'll have no idea why. And there's no tooling. And suddenly you're panicking and you're not a developer and you're in over your head and you call your buddy, which happens to be the support line of one of these companies. And of course, they're, you know, largely freelance organizations, not funded, no real customer support teams to speak of. You can't really get the help you need. And then it just kind of withers away on the shelf. And we've heard this story from many people who use these devices. And so again, they are more valuable than nothing at all, but what is needed here is a operating system that anyone can use in perpetuity, right? It's not about just getting it installed. It's so easy to plug something in and have a bunch of things running and be like, I did it. But check back in 2 years and see how that's going for them. You need the ability to update this software, right? And not in a bundled approach. You need the ability to update individual pieces of software that are installed on your server. For instance, if there's a bug that's found in the latest release of LND, you shouldn't also have to update at the same time your Bitcoin node and your Bitwarden server and your your BTC Pay server instance or your Messenger app, like, because maybe you don't want the newest version of one of those things, right? It's a bundled approach. It's sort of an all or nothing approach, not an a la carte module approach. You need the ability to configure them, which, as I mentioned, is a very challenging thing for most people, especially with advanced configurations like Bitcoin. And lastly, one of the biggest issues, when it comes to server-side software is dependency management. Okay, it's that some pieces of software rely not only on the existence, but on the proper configuration and health of other services like LND to Bitcoin. Okay. And so if something is going wrong with your Bitcoin node and you don't know how to fix it, what is your LND node doing? You could actually get into trouble here. You could lose money. Okay. So dependency management is more commonly known amongst professionals as dependency hell. These are highly trained individuals who do this for a living, and they call it dependency hell. How do you take dependency hell from a professional and make it dependency heaven for grandma? Right. That's a hard problem. So none of our competitors do any of this, right? There's no help with configuration. There's no help with dependency management. There's no module or a la carte updates. There's no health checks. There's new Embassy OS 0.3.0, which is coming out here soon, has a brand new feature, which is might sound trivial, but is a breakthrough in personal server technology, which is just a simple thing called health checks. Every service defines for itself what constitutes health. It is able to look at itself and say, am I healthy? The operating system does this. Embassy OS monitors every service and says, are you healthy according to your own criteria of what constitutes health, right? Meaning Bitcoin could say, I'm not healthy if I am unreachable on my P2P interface. So Embassy OS will constantly check Bitcoin's P2P interface to see if it's up and healthy. And if it's not, it will alert you that it's not, show you in the GUI that the P2P interface is experiencing troubles, and tell you how to fix it. If it can't fix it itself, which oftentimes it can, if it's a known issue that we expect to happen,
right?
Because like I said, these things just are expected to happen. Server-side software has problems, sometimes expected problems. And not only can it check Bitcoin to see if Bitcoin is healthy, but Embassy OS will check Bitcoin to see if LND is healthy, because LND has told Embassy OS that I care about the health of Bitcoin.
Right.
And so you as a user don't have to understand or know any of this. Embassy OS handles all the configuration, all the dependency management, all the health checks. Absolutely everything is done through a graphical user interface, a website, a very familiar looking website. You never have to SSH into the box. You never have to use the command line. In fact, that's a principle of ours. We have a zero command line principle as a company. Now, you can use the command line, right? It's in the developer options of the operating system. You put an SSH key on it, go onto the command line, hack in, do whatever you want. It's your device. We're not going to stop you from doing it. We can't. But it is never necessary on our system. And we are the only ones who can make that claim.
Yeah. I'd love for you to kind of cover the convenience that you guys offer, but really based in, you know, the service options, because this is open source. And I think it's kind of important to sort of elaborate on, you know, how you can acquire or obtain your services and the different configurations, whether it's just Embassy or Embassy OS or just, or those combined.
So when you say acquire our services, you mean Start9's services, not the services that run on the Embassy.
Right. So So whether the actual device, or I can build a device myself and get Embassy OS, or I can just maybe open source the whole thing, and kind of what your approach or why you took that approach.
For sure. Yeah. There are three ways to get an Embassy, I'll call it. Number one is to buy the fully assembled, pre-built, pre-compiled device from us. It's a piece of hardware, comes in the mail, couple simple instructions, plug it in. It's easier to set up than an Amazon Alexa. We've never met somebody who wasn't capable of doing it, and we've sold to some people who shouldn't be capable of doing this. That's the easiest way to do it. And that's how we monetize as well, right? So oftentimes people who could do it themselves actually buy from us because they want to support the project. We support them for that. Mm. So that's one way. The second way is to assemble the hardware yourself, right? And this is fantastic for people who live outside of the United States because of shipping costs, customs, right? So they go locally and buy hardware because we've chosen to build Embassy using commoditized hardware for exactly this purpose, so that we would never be a central point of failure of the necessary hardware. So if you live in another country and you want to pay exorbitant shipping fees, all you do is go down the street, buy the hardware that you need to buy, put it together. It's very simple to do. We have lots of people in the US who do this as well. And then you buy the operating system from us. So we sell the operating system fully compiled with a product key flashed onto it. And it's just a download. And then all you have to do is take that downloaded file, flash it to a micro SD card, right? By plugging it into the computer, click flash. It's very easy to do. And then you take the micro SD card, put it into the hardware you assembled, and you're up and running. That's number two. The last option is the least, it's the one that fewer people do, but you can build the code from source. So our code is source available. It's on the internet. You can read it, audit it, fork it, change it, download it. There are no restrictions on what you as an individual can do with our code for your own personal use. You can do anything you want with it, including changing it, and even redistributing the changed code. You are allowed to do that under our licensing. So we are what many would call a source available license, but we're actually a little bit more than that, in that we allow you to do anything you want with our code for your own personal use. And we allow you to redistribute changes to the code to anyone anywhere in the world. The only thing that we prohibit you to do is to make money off of those changes. That's it. It's a non-commercial license. So you can do anything you want as long as you don't try to take what we've built and build a fortune on it. That's it. And maybe someday we'll even get rid of that. But anyway, as of today, you can go on and download the source code, compile it using a guide, and then build the hardware yourself and be up and running and have never done business with us. And we think that that's absolutely critical, that that is possible. We in no way want to be a point of failure for this technology. The availability of the technology is more important than the survival of Start 9.
I think it goes beyond that. I think it's critical for you and me and all of us because it protects all of us. Yes. It eliminates you guys from being a single point of failure. And it provides assurances to us that we can read, audit, and do whatever we want with the code. So it just seems like a huge win-win. And, you know, quite frankly, I was more than happy to buy the whole thing from you guys because it just made it very easy. I hope you guys are enjoying this fantastic rip with Matt Hill on sovereign computing as much as I am. But before we get back into it, I want to share some new information with you for Bitcoin 2022. The Sound Money Fest will feature a headline performance by Logic, and new speakers have been announced for the main stage, including Dylan LeClaire, Haley Lennon, and Alex Svetsky. Dylan was on episode number 62 of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast, where we discussed the conclusion of the long-term debt cycle and the rise of Bitcoin. And Alex was on episode number 12, The End of Globalism. I highly recommend you go back and check those out if you haven't already done so. The Bitcoin 2022 conference, which celebrates Bitcoin over 4 days next year, April 6th through 9th, with four different passes. The 4 days include Industry Day, 2 days of main events and speakers, and lastly, a festival day, which is a day of music and networking. Prices will continue to rise over the next few months, so get in early and use our affiliate code for 10% off. Remember to use the code BitcoinMatrix for 10% off your tickets at checkout. And now, let's get back into the Bitcoin Matrix with Matt Hill, where we discuss the dark web, operating the embassy, and how to truly own your own data. I think it's important to note or talk a little bit about how you guys achieved this convenience or this extreme ease of use and usability around sort of maybe, I don't know if it's wrapping the software, but it is incredible where I wanted to use LND before Bitcoin Core, and I can't because it's dependent on, and it prompts me, and then I go back to Bitcoin Core, and it all, whether I go into any configuration, it kind of really helped me go through that. How do you guys achieve that?
It's hard. it's good coding. Yeah, I mean, Aidan McClelland, one of the founders. So the three founders of Start9 are myself, Keegan McClelland, and his brother, Aidan McClelland. We have all participated in many conversations and learning experiences as we've gone through this process for now 2 years. Start9 is now 2 years old. And we have learned a lot about the challenges of our problem set, right? What we're trying to achieve, which is why I keep saying it's not easy. Like when we started out, we thought it would be hard. 2 years later, we're learning how wrong we were, how much harder it actually is to do well and at scale. And so Aidan, as of now, and this wasn't the case from the get-go necessarily, but as of now, Aidan is the primary architect of Embassy OS. The new Embassy OS 030 is largely the brainchild of Aidan. I personally, along with Drew Ansbacher, one of our other developers, wrote all of the front-end code. So everything that you see, right, the graphical user interface was predominantly written by me and a little bit Drew, who has been recently brought onto the team. But that's kind of the, you know, that's not hard stuff. You know, it's hard in a technical sense. Like it requires a lot of work and there's some creative design work that's needed. And sure, we're doing some pretty sophisticated things under the hood, like utilizing WebSockets for a real-time connection over Tor so that, you know, 030, you will get real-time feedback from your embassy. So you'll be looking at the screen and things will be changing in real time rather than utilizing some polling mechanism or having you refresh the page. Like it's going to feel very performant, very fast. And so that kind of stuff is challenging. So I don't want to diminish what I and Drew have done on the front end. But the meat of what makes Embassy, is Aidan's and Keegan's and the rest of the development teams. But Aidan being the primary architect, his creativity on how to solve these problems. Embassy OS is just a very sophisticated piece of software and how it interacts with the services. So to give a glimpse of kind of the main aspect of Embassy OS that makes it beyond other products in the marketplace is the way that services are packaged and Embassy OS's ability to utilize that packaging. So oftentimes when you hear something being packaged, you think about, well, there's this thing and it's amazing. And then you package it. Well, that's just like throwing it in a box and putting some tape on it, right? Put it in a Docker container. Call it a day, right? And again, this is kind of what a lot of our counterparts do. And many of the times it's already in a Docker container. So all they're doing is literally just taking the thing and putting it over here. It's not a lot of work, but you sort of get what you pay for, so to speak, right? You have this sort of dumb thing that's now just running on the OS. And if you want to know anything about it, you have to dig into the Docker container. You have to SSH into the box. You have to exec into the Docker container and start asking it questions. And you've immediately just cut out 99% of the population. Mm-hmm. So what our packaging process looks like, it's more intensive, is it requires an enormous amount of metadata. So take Bitcoin, for instance. You want Bitcoin on the embassy. Our wrapper for Bitcoin is actually an application of its own. So there's Bitcoin at the core, right? And then you have the wrapper that goes around Bitcoin. It's packaged for Embassy OS in a way that Embassy OS can digest it, can ingest it. And the metadata that surrounds Bitcoin Core has everything to do with, say, configuration, right? I mentioned there's hundreds of configuration options for Bitcoin Core. So when we packaged Bitcoin Core, we enumerated every single one of those options. We put what the user could possibly fill in, like, oh, it requires a number, like prune height. Okay, well, what are the bounds of that? Can the user enter -300? No, because block -300 doesn't make any sense. There's no such thing as block -300. So we put in bounds. So not only did we say, all right, for prune height, they have to enter this They have to enter a number between this and this amount. It must be an integer, no decimals required, right? No decimals allowed. And by the way, here's the description. In case you don't know what this setting is and you're interested, here's a full description of what this setting is going to do to your embassy. Oh, and lastly, if you change this number, here's what's going to happen. Let's say you change the prune height or something. Well, Bitcoin Core, as a reaction to that change in the configuration, is actually going to maybe go back and do some resyncing. Well, shouldn't you know that? Wouldn't you like to know that if you're going to make this change so that you're not surprised by the fact that Bitcoin is now sinking again? So it tells you that as well. It has a little warning on it that says, if you change this number, here's what's going to happen. So the configuration of Bitcoin D is now this pleasurable experience where you can't screw anything up. You know what everything is. It tells you what's going to happen if you hit save, and then you can choose to hit save, right? And that requires an enormous amount of metadata. Like, we had to write all that stuff. Mm-hmm. We had to understand what all of these things were and package it all up. That's just config. Now take something like LND, where LND has dependencies. You know what? Here's a good example that'll highlight what it can do. BTC Pay Server, okay? BTC Pay Server, from a server-side software perspective, is actually a layer 3 product, okay? There's Bitcoin, there's Lightning, and then there's BTC Pay. And so BTC Pay Server needs a Bitcoin node. Mm-hmm. And if you want to enable Lightning, which you don't have to, it also needs a Lightning node. However, BTC Pay Server accommodates both C Lightning or LND, not both, one or the other. Mm. How does Embassy OS deal with something like this? It's actually very sophisticated, okay? So here's how it deals with it. You go into your BTC Pay Server configuration settings, and you can go in and click Lightning enable, right? So you enable Lightning. Embassy OS config will then be like, what do you want to use? Do you want to use C Lightning or LND? You select C Lightning. A warning will pop up, right? If you choose C Lightning, you're also going to need to install C Lightning, but you don't currently have C Lightning installed. So just be aware that BTC Pay Server Lightning will not work until you install C Lightning and it is fully synced. So now you hit save. BTC Pay Server will automatically go into a dependency issue state. It will not let you do things that are going to hurt the system until that dependency is satisfied. So that is also additional metadata that needs to be packaged with the wrapper. Then you have health checks, which I mentioned earlier, right? Health checks is scripts that Bitcoin D tells Embassy OS to run against it. It says, all right, here's 6 things that if you do and they all come back with thumbs up, I'm healthy. So we have to write those scripts. These are things that a technical individual would normally do on the command line. They would go to the command line, they would type in these commands and scripts, and then they'd be like, oh, okay, that's good. Okay, that's good. Okay, that's good. My node is healthy. Well, we wrote those scripts and gave them to Embassy OS, and Embassy OS now acts as that technical individual and is constantly checking your Bitcoin node for health. So the package had to have those scripts in it as well. We have something called properties, which is arbitrary information that the user may care about from the service. So for instance, Bitcoin has a sync height. How synced is your node? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How would you normally figure this out in the technical world? You would go to the command line, type in a command that returns, I think it's current block height, and it would return the current block height of the sync. Well, because that is a command on the command line, we package it up into a script that runs that command and then reports it into the properties section of Bitcoin D. So if you go to Bitcoin D on your embassy and you click properties, all this information about your Bitcoin node is going to come out. And all of those are developer defined, meaning whoever packaged Bitcoin D, in this case, it was us, we made the determination of what we think people are going to care about their Bitcoin node. Right. And we pre-compiled all these scripts so that it's all just sitting there waiting for you and you never have to go to the command line to find these things out. And we can iterate this. In other words, these packages can become more sophisticated and more powerful over time. Mm-hmm. So Bitcoin is iterating and getting more powerful over time. And our wrapper for Bitcoin is also iterating and getting more powerful over time in order to produce the optimal user experience. So it's a non-trivial thing to take on the packaging of a service for Embassy OS. Now, hello world, if you want to just package up a service real quick and make it available on Embassy OS, takes minutes potentially, depending on how complicated the service is. Meaning you don't need to do all these things. You don't have to write a bunch of health checks. You don't have to do properties, right? There's a couple things that you do have to do, like config, for instance, but most services don't have big configs. Bitcoin's an exception in that sense. It has a ton, so is LND. But things like Bitwarden, there's really nothing to configure. It's just kind of one size fits all. Here's your server. So some services are very easy to package. Others require an enormous amount of work, like BTC Pay server is probably the largest, most complicated service that we have to package because it has these mutually exclusive optional dependencies, configuration options, health checks. It's like a very complex, huge, amazing service. And so, that's how it does it.
That's awesome. What is the open source self-hosted ecosystem like, and what do you see it, how do you see it going over the next 1 to 3 years?
I would call it good, but in need of some TLC, right? Tender love and care. The open source self-hosted software in the world today. Look, the open source ecosystem is rich, okay? I mean, decades and decades of open source projects. The challenge is maintenance, right? So a lot of them just kind of wither away, right? Because a lot of times they're not monetized. And so they struggle to keep development effort. Even the ones that do get a lot of community attention, sometimes that kind of withers, you know? Some have been able to maintain high degrees of maintenance from the community. Some have been able to raise money charitably in order to continue development efforts. But by and large, open source self-hosted applications, we'll call them services, are behind the curve on their centralized hosted counterparts. Like Google is very convenient. It's very good, okay? Nextcloud is also very good, but Google is still better when it comes to the user experience, right? And that's just because they have tons of money and tons of engineers and, you know, R&D departments and everything like that. So open source self-hosted stuff tends to be on the, at least on the application side of things, the protocol side of things is usually ahead, like Linux, for example. But on the application side, it tends to lag. But Bitcoin has done something to the world, right? Bitcoin has enriched an interesting group of people. And by that, I mean a great group of people, right? Like the open source world is getting more attention now than it did, not just because there's people willing to be stewards of it, but because more and more we're realizing the importance of it. We're realizing the importance of self-hosting, of at least source code being available, source available, but at best being fully open source. I think it's going to get a lot of love. I think we're going to surprise the big tech giants over the next, you know, maybe not 1 to 3 years, but over the next decade. I think we're really going to surprise them because they have put in decades of research and development and iteration on their own products to create the optimal user experience. Like when you pick up a Google app on your phone, it just speaks to you. It does exactly what you want it to do in the way that you want it to do it. Meaning they have done all the research. We don't need to go innovate on that right now. All we need to do is take all of the research that they've done and apply it to self-hosted open source software. Like they've given us the blueprint. Here's how you make a great app. So let's go make those apps, but let's make them open source and self-hosted. And sure, maybe they'll then come up with something else that pushes the envelope. But I actually think we're in a period of history here where we've sort of maxed out the user experience of the mobile phone and the computer. I don't think that there's a whole lot more that you can do with a laptop, desktop, or mobile phone to make it easier to use. I mean, it swipes. It's just everything just does what you want it to do. I mean, there hasn't been a major innovation in cell phone hardware or software in a while. It's all just better and better.
But it is pretty amazing. Not the risk that we're taking on or the digital footprints, but the convenience and the ease of use. And
it's fantastic. Brilliant engineering and product development. You can't take that away from them.
And addictive. And
to be honest, most of the people that are developing it are good people too. I'm not even blaming the people who write the software or build the devices. It's the parent corporations that are, you know, the bad guys of this story, not necessarily the people who work for them, depending on who they are. But like, we think that they've done a great job teaching us how to create a positive user experience, which is why Embassy OS feels like a normal website. It's nothing crazy. You log into your embassy and you're like, oh, this is familiar. You don't realize that you're doing something radical.
Right.
Something that's never been done before. You're managing your own personal server, which is a device in your home, and it's running over Tor on the dark net. And it's like, you're doing all this crazy stuff. And all it really feels like is that you're using a website.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it is a huge aha moment. The way I went from not your keys, not your Bitcoin on my Bitcoin journey, not your server, not your data.
Data, that's right.
Not your digital footprints. And it irks me how exposed I've been. And I find that I'm at the beginning of that journey, like when I learned about our hardware wallet. And I was like, oh shit, now I got to buy one. I got to choose which one. I got to learn how to use it. I got to learn how to protect it. I got all these things, but I want to do this. And until I do it, I'm in this place of vulnerability. And it then makes you reflect on not just how you've been exposed, but all the different ways you're exposed. And this is just, it's been a godsend in the way that I'm able to grasp these things back. And it's kind of like with Bitcoin, where it's not how much you have, it's that those first Satoshis where you're like, I can take this money and it's on a ledger that no other party owns. And in a way that means I own it, and it's just me versus the network. Is a very different experience than where I would even use the word allowed or have been allowed on the public web. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't the intention, I don't think, of what we were going for is I don't think the people who built the web were hoping it would turn out this way.
So no, I don't think so either.
I'd love to hear.
I was just going to comment on something you said there, which is this emotion, this feeling that comes along with ownership, property, control over your own values. You know, we live in a world where it's the rent model. Even the home that you own is not fully yours, you know, property taxes and mortgage, and maybe it's like
property taxes.
You always sort of feel like somebody could take it from you. Mm-hmm. And there's a very precious, very powerful emotion that comes along with real ownership. For me, it actually feels like something from childhood when I would have like a box with my lucky rock or my like coin, you know, that my dad gave me, or like you sort of have like this box of precious things and it's like tucked in under your bed or something, or there's something very precious about that, very human about it. There you go. and you know, knowing that they're secure. I remember being a kid and I would set up a little alarm on my room. So I bought those little magnets from like the Radio Shack, you know, where if they separate, you can hook it up to a speaker buzzer and it'll sound an alarm. So I like built myself a little door alarm on my room, so that anywhere I was in the house, if somebody walked into my room, it would buzz. And it wasn't that I was worried somebody was going to go into my room and steal things. And it's not that I was had things in my room that I shouldn't have. It was this idea of it's mine. Mm-hmm. It's my room. Mm-hmm. And I want it to be safe and secure for no other reason than the emotion of it. And we've really lost that as a society. We do everything in broad daylight, whether we realize it or not. And I think we do realize it, albeit on a subliminal level.
Yeah.
And so there's something very precious that comes with the idea of being private, of being alone, of being having something secure within your personal exclusive reach. And Bitcoin has really blown people's minds with this, especially once you grasp the mnemonic and the hardware wallet aspect of it. It's like, oh boy, this is, it's all right there, you know? It's right there and nowhere. It's my secret. And so, yeah, we want to extend that to all aspects of the digital life. We want you to feel like that with your passwords and your data and even your communications, knowing that when you hit send on that text message, that it is you and the person you are talking to. Not because there's some company in the middle saying, trust us, we encrypt, right? We don't give your information to anyone. But no, it's not that. It's because there is no one in the middle. The message is directly between you and the person that you're talking to. Truly private from anywhere in the world to anywhere else in the world. That's a very powerful idea. So,
yeah.
All right.
On both the internal and the external. The external being who you communicate with or who you interact with, but even internally, just being able to lock your stuff up. And it's not that you're hiding anything, but it's, I think a lot about like just my photos of my family. And it's not that I'm hiding anything or there's anything wrong with these photos, but like, I also just don't want my family on the internet or the public web. And I want control over that. And I don't want another company to have control over that, or another entity, I should say, because they always make mistakes or they have different incentives or they're honeypots or whatever they are. And so this is just a huge platform for me in terms of, it's just a huge plank of sovereignty alongside like Bitcoin, alongside flag theory and having multiple passports or having valid passports, whatever it is, the ability to just own your own stuff and selectively reveal what you want to reveal.
Yes.
So I'd love to hear what the future roadmap is like for Start 9 Labs. Because I think this stuff is very powerful. And I'd love to see where you guys are going and what your vision is for the company.
Yep. So we're on the verge of our biggest release ever. It is not some iteration of our previous operating system, Embassy OS 02X, you know, the version 2 and the version 3 are different operating systems. We didn't realize we were setting out to do a rewrite. We thought we were going to make some structural changes and make it more scalable, more flexible. It was already pretty good. What you're using right now is the old version, and it's pretty good, right? The new one's going to blow you away. The new version is a whole new animal. And so we have to get through this. We have to get this out and it needs to be good. So we know people are excited. We know people have been waiting patiently, for a long time, but, we are going to make sure that it is good before it comes out. We're not going to rush it out the door. And so as soon as that's out, we won't take long to rest. We will immediately move into the next phase of our development. We have a very long wish list, roadmap of features that we would like to build into Embassy OS. We have a very long, healthy list of services that we would like either ourselves or others to add to Embassy OS, because anyone can package a service. And then we have broader ideas, more long-term ideas about how this market evolves and where the opportunities will be, both in hardware and software. So, you know, our short-term roadmap after the 030 release will be published. We are going to open up our entire development roadmap publicly as soon as 030 is out. And you will be able to, anybody will be able to see exactly what features we'll be going into 031, for instance, and you will be able to track our progress on those features using, you know, ordinary sort of agile swim lanes. You'll see what's in the to-do column, what's actively being worked on, what's in testing, and what's done, and basically track publicly our progress on every iteration of the operating system. We think that this is important so that people understand what we're building and why. We think it's important for purposes of accountability. We think it's important to engage community and get as many people involved in the project as possible. And you're just never going to do that with closed doors, right? The code has always been open, but our internal efforts on a daily basis have not. We are going to be holding, maybe not daily, maybe daily. We haven't decided yet exactly, but calls that anyone can join, anyone in the world can join, where we provide updates to each other, which is something we already do. It's our daily stand-up, but we are thinking about either every day or some days opening that up to the public, where we're not going to take questions. We're not going to engage the community in conversation, but anyone can listen in on our internal operations and challenges and questions. And because we really do want this to, you know, remain and become even more of a open, welcoming global project. You know, we don't need a bunch of community developers to come in for us to achieve our goals. We have the internal talent and drive and work ethic to do it, but every little bit helps. And everyone who wants to contribute, we want them here with us. So, I mean, without getting into the details of what those are, I could mention a few. Multiple drive support is going to be a big one. So O3O enables external drive support, SSDs, as opposed to running off of the micro SD, which is a massive, massive improvement, a very necessary one. But in a very near-term release after that, you will be able to add more SSDs to your setup, either to augment your storage space or to mirror the drive that is already on the embassy. Real-time mirroring, atomic updates to both hard drives. This is very important when it comes to things like Lightning, right? Because you don't want any downtime on your node. So if you're running Lightning and one of your hard drives starts to fail, having another drive that has exactly, provably identical data on it, the operating system will just start using that drive instead of the one that's failing. And so you never miss a beat. A very popular technology for accomplishing this is something called RAID. We are not going to use RAID specifically because it's a bit over-engineered for the particular use case that we are going after. But effectively, and arguably more effectively, it will do the exact same thing that RAID affords, which is the data redundancy for zero downtime. So multiple hard drive support is going to be a big one. Disk encryption is another big one, so that if somebody gets their physical hands on your physical embassy, everything is encrypted at rest. Now, this is a very complicated feature to implement, not because it's hard to do disk encryption, but because with disk encryption, your embassy cannot even boot up until you enter your password, because the data is encrypted. And if the embassy could decrypt the data, it means that the decryption key is on the embassy. So if anybody gets your embassy, yay, it's a bunch of encrypted data, but the key to decrypt it is in the embassy. So the only way to do full disk encryption is for you to provide the decryption key. So what that means is if your power ever goes out, the embassy will not even be able to start back up without input from you. So in order to accommodate this, what it means is that somebody has to be watching your embassy. Not somebody, but you need to be watching your embassy. Like, how do you know if the power goes out? You can't just rely on, you're not going to go to your phone and check if your embassy is healthy every 5 minutes, right? There could be whole days that go by when you don't even visit your embassy's website and you would have no idea that it was down because it never came back up. Right? In the world today, if your embassy goes down, your power goes out, comes back on, you're back up and running. You'd never even know that it went down. Mm-hmm. But if the power goes out and your embassy goes down, it can't tell you that it went down because it has no power. It's off. So how do you know? Well, what it means is that somebody else needs to be watching your device and then alert you via email or whatever if your embassy is not reachable. We're building this. And so that's another big one. So that embassies, wow, you'll be able to have sort of like monitoring buddies, like you and somebody else will be able to be like, I'll watch your embassy if you watch mine. And there's no real security vulnerability here because they don't even have to give you their embassy's primary Tor address. They would give you a Tor address that is specifically just to check if the thing is healthy. And then you would be able to notify them, not you, the human, your embassy would notify them if their embassy goes down and vice versa.
Mm.
Yeah. So everyone's watching each other's backs. I could pull out our roadmap right now and take up the next hour of time. I'm not going to do it. We have a massive, never-ending roadmap of features. And
I hear you. One of the reasons I ask, just because I'm super excited about where this is going, and I'm not talking about in like 3, 5, 10 years for the individual, but I really do wonder what it would be like in 50 years. You know, in the perfect case scenario.
Yeah, we can do that thought experiment.
Yeah, I'd love to hear what you think the world somehow would look like and how, or what that means or how it's different if this becomes a technology that everyone uses, similar to how some of us think that Bitcoin will become, you know, the money of the future and everyone will use Bitcoin.
Yeah. I don't know if it's 50. I don't know if it's 20.
I drew it out long. Yeah.
But here's where I think this goes. I think that if you walk into the boardroom at Apple or Google, Microsoft, Amazon, and you ask them what their vision of the future is, I think whether they tell you directly or not, they're going to tell you that it is a smart world, an integrated smart world filled with brilliant devices that are all connected in the cloud, serving your every need. You walk into your home and you say a word and your lights turn on and your doors lock automatically and your thermostat keeps the perfect temperature and your refrigerator tells you when a shelf is too light because it knows you're running out of beer. It just is this wonderful world where the machines serve us, okay? And if you ask them what their position in that world would be, it'd be right in the damn center of it. They would know that you're out of beer, okay? Because it's plugged right into their cloud. And every one of these devices is both serving you and watching you. And you know what? As long as you don't misbehave and you do what you're told, you don't say the wrong things, you don't violate their terms of service, and you pay their extortionary subscription fees because they will be extortionary, then you'll be allowed to have cold food and your doors will lock when you leave. Step out of line, don't pay your bill. Suddenly your physical life is actually in danger. We're not talking about Google Drive here, where the worst possible thing that can happen is your pictures get deleted. We're talking about Google door locks here, where the worst possible thing that can happen is you can't get into your house.
Or out.
It's a terrifying future. They wouldn't present it as terrifying because why? Because they value your privacy. They value you as a customer. You are important to them. Someone will be with you shortly. Click. Okay. So that's the future they envision. Here's the future we envision. A smart home of connected devices serving your every need, where your beer on your shelf, right? The shelf of your refrigerator tells you when you're running low on beer. It's the same future. We imagine the same future.
Right.
There's just nobody in the middle of it. Why? Right. It's you buy the devices. They communicate with each other. They communicate to you. They coordinate in the cloud. It's all the same thing. There's just no Apple in the center of it. Sovereign individuals being served by smart robots. It's the future I'd like to see. And to make that future a possibility, you need a couple of things. you need decentralized internet infrastructure. Now, the internet itself is arguably somewhat decentralized, right? There are central entities, points of failure, ISPs, email is a highly centralized thing, but the actual fiber optic cable, you know, can be sort of repurposed for decentralized usage, as we've seen with Bitcoin and things on the embassy and things like Tor. Also, you have the possibility of mesh networking, right? Which, you know, we are selling devices and operating system software that people are putting onto devices in their homes. Well, to have a viable mesh network, you need devices in close proximity of each other. Now that technology is getting better and they can shout further and further. And there's things like towers that you can use as almost a federation approach to mesh networking. But ultimately, mesh networks grow. They are not planted. You can't build a mesh network. Any company that tells you we're building mesh networks, they have a chicken and egg problem. That's like saying you're going to build a social network. Nobody wants to be on your social network because nobody's on your social network. It's sort of an all or nothing game unless you grow it organically. As in, you people are buying the devices that will eventually serve as mesh networking devices, not because they're mesh networking devices. They're buying them for other personal, private, non-mesh reasons, AKA an embassy. So if somebody buys an embassy and they're using it for password management to run a Bitcoin node and yada, yada, and then somebody down the street buys an embassy for those same reasons, and then somebody over here buys an embassy, and then suddenly one day, Embassy OS has this new feature that you can toggle on that says enable mesh networking, and suddenly you can turn this thing on and nobody even really saw it coming. It was an organic emergent property of a naturally occurring system. So that's where this goes, is we think that to have the intelligent robot future that is free of centralized authoritarian control, you need decentralized infrastructure in the form of physical hardware, physical wiring, and mesh networking over the air technology. Secondly, you need decentralized open source protocols that these computers can use to speak to each other, everything from TCP/IP, HTTP, Bitcoin, LND, right? These are all protocols that can be implemented in many different languages, but they're all adhering to the same protocol specification. And then you need services. You need applications that are capable of utilizing these underlying protocols to serve real practical human needs.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is all of these are being built very quickly, much faster than people think, right? We arguably are the leader in the hardware infrastructure portion of this. Like, I believe Start9 Embassy is probably the number one device in the world as a contender for becoming the home thing that will connect the world in a decentralized way.
Wow.
And that's the position we intend to retain and improve upon, actually.
Yeah. Awesome. I think this stuff is cypherpunk as fuck.
It is.
It's so important and it gets me so, riled up, and I just want it to happen quickly. My final question for you is along the lines of what's coming up. I know you guys are going to be in Atlanta for the conference, but you mentioned before in our pre-talk a little bit about 3D printing, gardening, and farming, and maybe how that plays in with the embassy. And one of the things I'll say there, though, is I maybe it's possible, but I can't wait till you get 3D print the parts to build the embassy. I do think that will be very important as we go forward, maybe in places like Australia or China, or where goods are just not going to be imported for certain reasons or things like that. Mm-hmm. But I'd love to hear about the 3D printing and the gardening.
Well, 3D printing enclosures for computer hardware is perfectly reasonable and easy to do even today. 3D printing microchips, mm-hmm. processors is not. Ultimately, that's going to be a bottleneck and potential point of failure for any kind of, you know, sovereign computing endeavor. If Apple and Google and Microsoft literally own the mines where this stuff is mined out of the earth, ultimately they can control the supply chain and starve out anyone who's not building computers that conform to their future. I mentioned to my partners very early on in this endeavor, I said, if we do our job and we do it well, there's going to come a day, decades from now, when we will own the mines, because it's the only way to ensure the survival of something this disruptive to the global status quo. I don't think we'll ever get there. Maybe we will. We're going to try. But that is the end game of this. You either control your own destiny or you subject to somebody else's vision of the future, or you get lucky, right? But I don't want to get lucky. I want to build a particular kind of future. And I know that we are going to have somebody in our way every step of the way. And the more we matter, the more success we have, the bigger the enemy gets. It's like playing a video game. You fight the boss, then the bigger boss, then the final boss. And at the end of the day, you know, the final boss for what we are trying to achieve here is the hardware supply chain, right? If that's the final boss. Software, they can't stop us.
Right.
Can't stop software. But the software doesn't matter if the hardware is compromised. So we're in a good position right now because there's a lot of open, trustworthy, commoditized, available hardware on the market. But we can't rely on that forever. I'm also not worried about it going away this year. I don't think it's an immediate threat, but it is on the distant horizon that, you know, we're going to end up needing access to rare earth minerals and, you know, we're going to need to build our own chips. Took Apple, what, 40 years to switch over to their own chip. I think they used to use their own chip a while back, but then got on the Intel and now they're back on their own. But it's not an easy thing to literally manufacture, vertically integrate your entire hardware supply chain.
Yeah. Well, I'm stoked that you guys are on our team. We have a lot of work ahead of us, but I'm, like I said before, I'm really excited about what you guys are doing. And to me, it's brought a lot of comfort that I can utilize these tools going forward as I migrate my life over to just more and more sovereignty through sovereign computing. So I've learned a ton through this conversation. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed it. Just let everyone know where they could find you and Start9 Labs and the embassy.
We're at start9.com. We finally dropped the labs. easier to say and communicate. I think our emails are still have labs at the end of them, but we'll switch that to eventually. So start9.com. We're on Twitter as start9 at start9 labs. Couldn't get rid of that. We're accessible. Our team, we've built quite a community. Our Telegram channel, at start9_labs, I think, has like 800 people in it and it's pretty active. It's a very helpful community. We get people who come in there and ask questions about, you know, how to use Calyx OS on their Pixel phone, how to things that aren't even related necessarily to what we do. And they get help there. It's a very technical, very experienced, very helpful, very good group of people that we have kind of attracted to our ecosystem. We also have chat channels on Matrix. We also have a super secret exclusive chat channel on Matrix Tor base that is only accessible if you're running Matrix over Tor. It doesn't need to be on an embassy, but that's pretty much the only way to run Matrix over Tor in the world today is on the embassy. So it's sort of like a we celebrate every person who shows up there. You know, we don't even know who they are, but it's somebody somewhere in the world who set up an embassy and installed all the things and then visited and they joined the tour. We call it the tour party room and they joined the tour party room and we're like, you did it. You're literally on the most sovereign private messaging experience that has ever existed. Congratulations. And you're in a room of a bunch of other people who have also done it. So yeah, we're very much a, an exciting and proud and welcoming group of people. And also very, very hardworking. We work a lot. But yeah, welcome to anyone who's listening to this. There's a place for you here.
Yeah. I want into the super secret matrix room.
Well, go get it, man. Install.
I'm going to work towards it, man. I'm inspired. Like I said before, it's sort of an inflection point where you just recognize the gravity of how exposed we've been, regardless of whether you recognize it or hated it the whole time. But and then to actually have an option out, you know, sort of like when you find Bitcoin, but a way out, and a way out that is not complicated to use or to get to. And not build, recreating the wheel yourself. You just plug and play. So I'm super excited about the technology you guys are putting out there and everything you guys are doing. So I can't tell you how much I've appreciated this conversation. It's been so dope, Matt.
I really appreciate you saying all that. Thanks for having me on. It's been great to get to know you better. And I'll be seeing you at the conferences.
This episode with Matt Hill on Sovereign Computing, the dark web, and truly owning your own data was brought to you by Ledin, Bitcoin Magazine, and the Bitcoin 2022 conference. Ledin.io is a secure, simple, and easy-to-use platform for managing and growing your digital wealth. If you want to see what it's all about and get $50 free in USDC when you take out your first Ledin loan, head over to start.ledin.io/Bitcoin Matrix. Last year, over 10,000 Bitcoiners came to celebrate Bitcoin at Bitcoin 2021. But for Bitcoin 2022, they're expecting tens of thousands of crazy Bitcoiners. It's going to be off the hook, and I hope to see you there and chill out with a cold beer. For 10% off, make sure to use the code Bitcoin Matrix at checkout. And thank you for listening. If you dig the chats, please make sure to subscribe, rate, review, and share with your friends and family. Stack stats, stay humble, and stay laser focused. This is Cedric. Peace.